Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues every week. It's brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher have been joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene, politics, science and controversy on Sustainable Lens on Radio, tonight at 7 o'clock, on podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher, who's not here tonight, and me, Samuel Mann. I'm in the office of Associate Professor Eva Collins in the Management School at the University of Waikato. She is coordinator of the Management School's Sustainability Committee and co-chair of the University's Environmental Sustainability Group. She's done a lot of work on the relationship between business management and sustainability. We shall talk about all of those things. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for having me.
Let's go back a few steps though. Where did you grow up?
I'm born and raised in Redondo Beach, California, in Los Angeles. Immigrated from here, from Washington, D.C. Lived for 10 years in Washington, D.C. and immigrated from D.C. to here.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
Good question. A writer, actually. I wanted to be a writer. And close by that was a teacher. So actually being an academic is a good outcome of those two.
What did you go off to university to do?
I liked politics quite a lot. So my undergraduate degree was in political science. I graduated from Portland State in Oregon. And I noticed in politics, I was interested particularly in environmental politics. And I felt like I would lose conversations because economics would get brought up. And I was tired of having that happen. And so I went and got a master's in political economy at the University of Essex in England so that I could argue back. And went then to the U.S. for my Ph.D. at George Washington University in D.C. and got my Ph.D. in public policy with an environmental focus. Never really considered being an academic at a business school or a management school. It wasn't what I had thought of, but it fit. I had some corporate background as well, and so it was a good fit.
Did you go off to Portland State with its green credentials, or was that an accident?
Definitely related. I did things like collected signatures at Grateful Dead concerts for environmental issues. I was an intern for a state senator who was chair of the Environment Committee, and it was the time of discussions about the last of the old growth forest, and loggers were protesting by circling in their logging trucks the Capitol in Salem. So environmental issues from way back. And I guess I would add to this, for because it impacts my background and the way I work, is I married an environmental lobbyist. So I was a corporate lobbyist in D.C., and my husband was an environmental lobbyist. He wasn't my husband at the time, but and so I ran in two different, very, very different communities, the corporate community and the not-for-profit environmental community, which also had strong links to the human rights not-for-profit community. And I heard the disconnect between those two communities and was interested in that and how much harder it is to keep that disconnect once you get to know people as a instead of being something that you could stereotype. It's a person with values and beliefs, and so that absolutely impacts the way I handle issues as well. Still married to him, and we still have lively dinner time conversation.
What's the role of the lobbyist in that?
So advocate to Congress and to the administration on behalf of your business. Very often it's done in a coalition type. So I teach this to my students, actually. We just had, except in the New Zealand system, people think that New Zealanders don't have lobbyists, but they do. And we just held a mock election under MMP system, so they get familiar with that. Even though they're Kiwis, they don't always understand the MMP system. And then we broke into MPs and lobbyists. And it's the same idea where you have to explain something in terms that is understandable, and why would they want to help you with this particular issue. And that's what I used to do for a living.
In movies such as Thank You for Smoking, yeah, it's portrayed as quite a dirty occupation.
Yep. It definitely is portrayed. In fact, there was, I have my students on Pinterest, and they pin something every week, and someone just pinned about a survey about that lobbyists are one of the least trusted in the U.S., and that would be absolutely true. You know, you would, if you were at a party and you said you were a corporate lobbyist, people kind of slid down the table from you and didn't want to talk to you. But actually, it's more transparent in the States than it is here. Green Party has tried to make it more transparent. If I lobbied here, there wouldn't be the kind of record keeping that there is in the States. I had to say I was a lobbyist. I had to say who I was talking to and what those issues were. And that was publicly available. So, yes, there's a perception of, and there's definitely some lobbyists who work in a particular way. But, yeah, I'd like to think that I had my values with me while I did my corporate job.
Was this before your PhD?
I got my PhD at the same time. My company had a program where they paid for the CEO of the company I worked for was United Technologies, and the CEO believed that the way that the company would be competitive was for continuous education. So he said, any kind of qualification you want to get, the corporation would pay for it. And so I had my PhD paid for by that company.
And they didn't put any restrictions on what you did?
Amazingly, no. And so everything was paid. You got paid time off to attend. You didn't have to stay after you graduated. So it was an amazing program.
So what led you to do a study on voluntary environmental programs?
Again, so the issues I lobbied on at the beginning were environmental issues. I ended with civil aviation issues, but at the beginning it was environmental issues. And I was interested in that practical aspect and about the role. Because I was involved at a government level, I saw the different vested interests and how hard it was to get environmental legislation through. And another approach to getting progress was for companies to come together and say, we're going to just step up for a variety of reasons and do this initiative. And I was interested in that. And that was what the PhD was on.
What's the dinner party version of your findings?
There is a role for voluntary environmental programs. It's not a replacement for government regulation. So government regulation tends to set the floor, and environmental regulation, voluntary environmental programs are the stretch for those leaders in the industries. It's showing others what can be done, but you also need to have that floor. And I would say in this country, we have a light floor.
Tell me about the role that you have here then. You've found yourself in a management school. You seem surprised.
it's a good fit. Because I am a believer that business can be more than just the problem. When I first arrived here, I went to the library and I checked out some environmental books, and this young librarian said, what is an academic from the management school doing checking out environmental books? And that's absolutely the perception. And part of my area of study is, so there's the incremental side about business doing the small changes, but then there are people who start a business, who are entrepreneurial, who start a business to solve a social and or environmental problem. And I'm very interested in that because, so you take my company, for the company that I used to work for, we had more global facilities than the U.S. State Department. If we decided to implement an environmental initiative, it had huge impact. And so I'm interested in the power of commerce to change these issues.
Interested in the power of commerce to change these issues. Do you buy the argument that it's largely commerce's fault?
I think that there's no denying that the majority of the problems are from business. I think individuals, consumers have a role and responsibility. I think government has a role and responsibility. But I do think that business has the reach, the resources that government no longer has, and increasingly the motivation to do something about these issues. You know, in my home state in California, NASA has just declared that there's 1 year left of water. And I just can't get my head around that. And that has huge implications for business, massive implications for business.
Given that,
yep.
Is it surprising that the response that you got from the librarian and I get all the time, what are you doing in the sustainability stuff? Given that the largely the cause and certainly a big chunk of the solution is in this space,
yeah.
Why is it still a surprise?
Interestingly, in this country in particular, business is considered a necessary evil. So, and I think that that positive aspect of business, at Waikato Management School, we've just started an entrepreneurship qualification. And one of the drivers for that was the increasing number of people coming to us who, particularly in the social side, but also in the environmental side, saw an issue and wanted to use business to solve that issue and wanted to get some qualifications to make sure that they did that successfully. So different from taking a not-for-profit or a trust, it's a different approach. And I think it has the potential to be much more impactful.
For those businesses that start in there,
yep.
I can certainly see that that's a good thing. We want to come back to talking about those ecopreneurs and social enterprise and whatever.
Yep.
But for the majority of businesses, are we still looking at characterizing their relationship with sustainability as compliance?
It's a good question. Probably so at this point, the majority. Although there are some hopeful and interesting things happening. And one of the things that's happening is KPMG has done this study on megatrends, and one of the megatrends you would be well familiar with is about transparency and increasing transparency. And that shift, one of the things I talk to my students about is the shifting values. So what used to be okay is no longer okay. And what I mean by that, Nike is a classic example where companies didn't used to be held accountable for what their suppliers were doing. Now they're absolutely held accountable for what their suppliers are doing. If there is a fire in Bangladesh, who are the garment makers and garment sellers in the developed world, and what's their accountability? And that starts to get looked at. And so hopefully a business doesn't do it at a crisis situation. So we've been studying the uptake in this country of businesses' social and environmental practices since 2003. And businesses in this country are really different from the U.S. For one thing, there's a lot more small businesses. And the other big difference is people think of sustainability and they think of environment. But New Zealand businesses are much more engaged in social initiatives, and that makes sense because they're small businesses embedded in their community. So they're helping out the local sports team, they're helping out the cancer drive, they're trying to be flexible with their employees, with what they offer, and I think that that makes a lot of sense. Environmentally, it's probably more compliant. Socially, it's probably much more proactive.
You raise the issue of the space that sustainability sits in, and when you talked about the role that you have in the institutional sustainability group, it is called the environmental sustainability group.
At the university, so I have my two roles at the management school. I'm the sustainability coordinator, and at the university level, it's environmental sustainability.
And does that exclude social things, or are you reinterpreting it?
It doesn't, and it does not exclude. And it's more of a clarifier of what our primary focus is. So we have other committees on campus that that look at social engagement, community engagement. But we can't ignore community engagement as part of what we do either. So the environment is meant to put the focus on it, but we look at it from a holistic perspective, which includes social, cultural, environmental, economic. And we look at these issues from what we call a strong sustainability perspective, where we're bounded by the environment. So it's often represented by the three circles of social, environmental, and economic. And those three circles are embedded into each other, with the environment being the one that is our boundary, basically.
Lots of people don't think it is really bounded. Mm. There's quite a lot of people that think, well, it's not really that finite. Well, it might be finite, but that's a theoretical concept. We've got a long way to go within those spaces.
And I would argue back on that. So one of the initiatives that myself and Professor Juliet Roper have been involved in is with the Sustainable Business Council. And the Sustainable Business Council linked their work to the World Business Council for Sustainable Development. And they got the top scientists in the world together to look at planetary boundaries and looked at where we were already pressing against those boundaries, over those boundaries, or just about to come up to those boundaries, and identified priority areas. And the work that Juliet Roper and myself did was to look at that from a New Zealand perspective, and we identified 9 priority areas. For example, water is one of the areas, and then to get to your is it theory or is it real? The members of the Sustainable Business Council looked at those. And they have this Vision 2050 and a program called Action 2020 for Vision 2050. So if this is what we want the world, New Zealand in particular, to look like in 2050, here's what needs to be in business plans in 2020. So that's very practical, on the ground, hands-on stuff. It's not just, I think it's way past the theoretical.
In terms of those planetary boundaries, that's taking the Rockstrom approach. Mm. What's the biggest threat to New Zealand in terms of those boundaries?
Water, biodiversity, those are big ones for us. Those are the ones that really, climate change, because those are the three top ones.
And water is the one that does seem to be hitting the fan, so to speak.
Yes.
My fear about treating that sort of planetary boundaries one is that it does reduce everything to resources. What's in this for us?
Another way of looking at that is that businesses have not historically thought about the pricing of environmental services. And that planetary boundaries work starts to put that in language that makes sense to business. And so it's not the end-all be-all, but it's a necessary step. And actually, I think it changes the language. It changes the mindset. And so I actually think it's more... I guess self-interest might be the starting point, but that's okay. I'm okay with that if it gets us to where we need to go. And so on water in particular, which is, again, with Juliet Roper and Maui Hudson and Sandy Morrison at the university, we just put in a proposal for Marsden looking at equitable distribution of water. And in New Zealand, we've had the system of first come, first serve. And that has led to what some would argue are inequitable outcomes. And now we're nearing the end of available water, which is going to impact business as far as development. It's going to impact cities as far as development. But just getting that onto people's radar, because in Canterbury, it might be a little bit easier to understand that water is an issue, but here in the Waikato, with a big river flowing down and rains all the time, water doesn't initially jump to people's mind as an issue. And yet the Waikato River, according to the Waikato Regional Council, is going to be fully allocated within the next 5 years.
What's your take then on self-interest? Can we rely on people's self-interest, or do we need to get people beyond self-interest?
So I'll answer that by explaining a game I play with my students. It's from MIT, and they play it online in the class, and it's called Fish Banks, and it's been around for a really long time. And you're a fishing company, and you go out and you fish, and you sell your stock of fish, and you can buy more ships, or you can build new ships, you can sell ships, and you can fish close in, and you can fish far away. And MIT has done this across the world, and with the same result, that self-interest rules the day, and that the fishing stocks are overfished until it passes the tipping point and can't recover. This has been, they've used environmental groups, they've used environmental regulatory groups. Sometimes a few groups have managed to say, whoa, what are we doing here? So the example that MIT talks about is Harley-Davidson of all groups, because Harley-Davidson almost went out of business because no one was buying their big gas-eaten motorcycles, and they had to completely question everything that they did and rethink their business. And so when Harley-Davidson played the Fish Banks game, they didn't get sucked into self-interest. They questioned everything, and they came up with a cooperative model. And my students will argue with me that we wouldn't do this in real life. We've done this here in class, but if it was real life, we wouldn't do it. Well, I would beg to differ. And we talk about examples of real life examples and New Zealand examples of where we have taken every last bit of the resource until we're at the tipping point. So that's where, and it brings us back to the start of this conversation, government has to have a role, because if we rely on just self-interest, I don't think we'll get to the outcomes that we're looking for. There's other things that we can do, and there's creative things that we can do, especially with social media. But government has to have a role here as well.
So if we can't rely on self-interest,
yep.
And I note the bits of economics in your background, does this not undermine all of economics?
No, of course not.
You're looking at me. What about this rational man thing? Is that not entirely about self-interest?
It is entirely about self-interest, but if we were just talking about the planetary boundary, and so, for example, economics might, and I'm not an economist, I better say that right now, because I know you're about to go talk to Dan Marsh. And, so one of the examples is have a carbon tax, price the true cost of what these the environmental services is, basically, instead of having it be an externality where the cost is passed on to the public, make it more direct cost. Does that make sense?
So are you saying that we would be rational, it's just that we can't be fully rational yet because we don't have all the costs?
Yes. Yes, thank you. Like I said, I'm not an economist. I do have that background because, but no, my colleagues downstairs can talk further about it.
But then how do you cost things that are less tangible?
So there's, again, they can talk to you about, there's something called contingent valuation, and you can ask people their willingness to pay. Now, the challenge with that is that people are notoriously say, oh, yes, I'll pay for it. And then they get to the place where they actually need to pay for it and they don't. So one of the areas that I work in is in businesses with a sustainability strategy. And what we have found is that people are willing to pay a little bit more for sustainability, but not a lot more. So, and an example I can use, one of the cases that we co-authored here in the strategy department is All Good Bananas. And All Good Bananas, in New Zealand, we eat a lot of bananas. We eat more bananas per person than anywhere else in the world, believe it or not, but we don't grow commercially our own bananas, so we import bananas. And once you look into how bananas are grown, it's a nasty business. It's like chocolate. It's like coffee. And Chris Morrison, who was the founder of Phoenix Organics Drinks and is now a founder of All Good Bananas, got together with a bunch of Kiwis and started to import fair trade certified bananas. And they were going up against big multinational corporations. And one of their strategies was using social media. And their business model, if you would have looked at it, getting back to our discussion earlier, if you would have looked at it at a purely rational choice mentality, why would anybody? So bananas are a low-cost commodity product. It means that we tend not to care what brand of bananas we buy. Grocery stores use them as a loss leader, so they'll put them at the front of a store and they'll discount them. And so what he was suggesting is that people would pay a little bit more if they knew their bananas meant that environmentally and socially they had a better impact. So the farmers were getting a fair price. There was, in some ways, nothing about the banana industry here in New Zealand would support that. Internationally, yes, but not here in New Zealand. They've done fantastic. They introduced it. They charge a dollar more a kilo for fair trade certified bananas. Dole tried to count, as they started to take market share away, Dole tried to counter that and put an ethical choice sticker on their bananas. That was not third-party certified, and ultimately they ended up having to take off that sticker.
So, you've given an example there of a business that has taken a sustainable strategy successfully.
Yeah.
But there's an undeniable tension between traditional business models and sustainability. Mm. Whether you look at the growth at all costs or the return to shareholders being paramount.
Yes, yes.
Do those things sit nicely with sustainability?
So there are absolutely tensions within what we teach at the management school and sustainability. And to me, that's my favorite part of sustainability, to tell you the truth. So this notion of and pressure to grow, the idea of quarterly returns, that short-term focus versus the long-term focus. But so this is the interesting part. As I said, there's a few different ways to look at this. At University of Waikato, we have a strong Maori focus, so that that indigenous perspective of taking a longer term view, and how that can influence our business models. This notion of, it's sometimes called biomimicry, about looking at nature as the ultimate business model. So in nature, there's no such thing as waste. Interface carpets is an example of that, where the carpet became the raw material for the new carpet. And that meant changing the business model. So businesses don't own the carpet, they lease floor coverings from Interface. The carpet is put down in tiles, because actually, when you look at carpet, it's 20% of the carpet that gets worn. There, at 80%, and so you can replace the carpets, and the old carpet becomes the new carpet. So it's also called circular economy, and shared consumption is one of my master's students is looking at shared consumption. So looking at those pressures on business and different ways to respond to those pressures is, to me, one of the most interesting parts about sustainability and strategy.
But if you start talking about circular economy or shared consumption,
yep,
those things seem like a threat to existing businesses.
Oh, well, I think it's not a threat, it's a different way of doing business.
Which is a threat if you don't want to change.
Which is a threat if you don't want to change. And so always with big change, there are companies who are going to embrace it, who have looked ahead and seen it, And those that are going to resist it. So an example of that is, and this links back to our earlier conversation about government, part of the sustainability survey we've been doing since 2003 includes climate change. And we did follow-up interviews. So we did the survey in 2012, and last year we finished up a series of interviews with a sample of those respondents of the survey. And we, one of the things we were quite interested in is carbon. And in this country, we have an emissions trading scheme. Some would say it's successful. Some would say it's not so successful. It hasn't really led to any significant change. And we ask companies, do you have a carbon target and a carbon strategy? And this is an example where some businesses are out there not waiting for government. So 20% of businesses that we surveyed had a carbon strategy. And then when we talk to them, a great many have a carbon strategy and they're not implementing it until they find out what government's going to do. So they're sitting back waiting to see what government's going to do, even though there's a really good business case to say, don't wait for government, go ahead and do this.
You talked about the interface model. Are there any other sort of business models that are wholly different that we should be holding up?
So another business that I can think of, a New Zealand business, is called 3R. And they take a waste stream and they make a product out of it. Or so, for example, they started with Paintwise. They're the program manager for Paintwise, and Resene Paints is an example of taking leftover paint and making something out of it. They've looked at car seats. They have a Seat Smart program. They do the ag recovery program, so on farm waste and taking that so that it doesn't go to landfill. So we have a few New Zealand examples, actually.
They sound like an interesting model because they're seeing their product, if you like, is being able to see waste streams as value.
Yes, and so one of the interesting things about them, I was talking to them about what they saw as their core competency. And they saw their core competency as really their ability to take diverse interest, which is competitors who are coming together and finding an industry-wide solution. And they talk about it as herding cats, you know, that's a particular skill set. But we also had a very interesting conversation about who's the customer. So in ag recovery, they run the ag recovery program for the Ag Recovery Trust, which is funded by levies from suppliers and manufacturers and distributors, but it's the farmers who use the program. So he was saying, you know, that's an interesting conversation. Who is our customer? And if they want to get bigger, more customer uptake, who pays their bills? Is it who funds their funders? Or is it who uses the program? So you can see the business model is very, very different.
So how do you get past the core of the business being sell more stuff and get a return to the shareholder as quickly as you can?
I think it goes back to planetary boundaries, really. The sell more stuff model, we don't have enough planets to support the sell more stuff model. So stuff either needs to be made better and last longer. We talk on this campus a lot about plastic because we have a big issue. Our number one drink seller is bottled water. It's the number one seller. And I'm quite keen to change that to make it a non-plastic container and drinking fountains across campus to take away that waste stream. That's not good for the business model we just talked about, but it is. I think there are numerous examples. Paul Hawken, an Ecology of Commerce, calls it the take, make, waste model, and it's a linear model where the traditional business model is you take stuff from the earth, you make your widget, and it gets thrown away. And Waste New Zealand did a study that showed that 90% of what we buy, which is incredible, gets thrown away within 6 months. That's not just, my students always say, is that food? It's not just food. And so that's the model that needs to be changed. And there's a lot of scope in there if you change that take, make, waste model into that going back to the circular economy. I think there's huge scope for business to be successful if they look at different ways of doing business. And that I believe that change is going to be forced on them. And that's why I'm very keen to teach this to my students, because we might be getting away with it now, but I don't think we're going to be getting away with that take, make, waste model for very long.
Do all students do your courses, or do they have to opt into it?
In the management school, we've had a big debate about, do you do sustainability separate, or do you do it integrated into all your papers? It's a similar debate as ethics has been. And so what we've decided to do is both. We've just finished, or we're finishing a survey of all the courses we teach. And I'm happy to say almost every course we teach has at least some sustainability component. And at the same time, we have sustainability-focused papers. So I teach a first-year course called Management and Sustainability. I teach a second- and third-year course called Strategies for People, Planet, Profit. And I teach a fifth-year course called Strategies for Sustainability. So those three are examples of sustainability focused papers, but I also teach the capstone course for the Bachelor of Management Studies, and that's strategic management. And sustainability is woven throughout that course, and they're really expected to apply. We don't really teach sustainability in that course. We expect them to apply the sustainability they've learned throughout their education to the cases that we give them.
Are you able to characterize what it would mean to be a sustainable practitioner in business?
That is a hotly contested topic, but I can give you my definition. So I think it's a values-led organization. And by that, I don't mean that money doesn't take into account, but that money is not the sole driver. And that's what I mean by values-led organization. That there's a long-term focus. So perhaps there is short-term loss, but longer-term gain. That it is a circular model, circular business model. And I need to put in there, adds to the social fabric as well. So you're treating your workers well, you're treating your community well.
And what is the role of the individual in that? Do they all have to buy into it?
What I've found is that in I'm interested in organizations that didn't start out sustainability focused and then become sustainability focused. And one of the reasons is the individuals. They have a champion who is that person who just will not let it go and are willing to drive it. And then what happens is, if you start to do it at work and throwing away an apple in rubbish is no longer acceptable because compost is there and all your peers are throwing away the apple into compost, when you go home, it might start to feel funny to throw away the apple in the trash can, the apple core in the trash can. And so hopefully, the workplace infects the individuals. But I think it's two-way. You know, I don't think it's I think that people who have those values and come to work bring it, and that work can help spread those values to the home. I think it's two-way.
It's interesting because I would have thought it would be more the other way. Recycling something that I do at home.
Yeah, but not here. But not at work.
But not at work.
Why?
Or maybe I do it in the lunchroom, but not as part of the main work that I do.
It wouldn't be part of your main work, but it's part of how you work. That's what I would say. And so hopefully it's not a... And with all the sustainability stuff, if it's over to the side, it's less likely to succeed. But if it's integrated in what you do, so it's how you do your job, then yeah, I think it is a big part of what we do.
Would you encourage students to badge themselves as being sustainable?
One of the things that I have my fifth year students do early on, because they find it transformational, is a sustainability audit. So for 1 week, they have to track their social and environmental impact. They have to track what they buy, where what they buy is from. They have to track whether their neighbors have complained that they're loud, whether they've volunteered somewhere, and then write me a report. And they find that absolutely transformational. So one of the experiences is they have to go through their trash, and they take photos, and they're amazed by how much they throw away and what they throw away and where else it could have gone besides landfill. And you don't know it until you know it. So yes, I want them to, I tell them at the end that we have learning objectives for our papers. My learning objectives is for them to help change the world. And that's how high of a bar I set. And that sounds really full of hubris, I guess, but I don't care. I want them to come back and then tell me and tell the current crop of students what they're doing out there in the business world.
But they're not going to change the world just with their own footprint, whether it's their personal footprint or their personal footprint at work.
They're the future business leaders, and they are going out and they're starting businesses and they're working within existing businesses. I disagree. I think they actually are the hope for the future. You know, people ask me all the time, don't you get depressed about these topics? And actually, I don't, because they're out there now. I've been doing this for long enough that my students asked me to set up a Facebook page with this paper of former students, because there's a network of them out there. They're all over the world now, and they're doing really cool things.
Some questions to end with then. Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Yes. Yes.
In what way?
I'm an activist in how I teach. So, for example, Skeptic, Beyond Lomborg, I give that reading to my students because I want them to see the different perspectives of sustainability. And it used to be that I gave them State of the World reading, and then I asked them to find a counter argument, to find the skeptic argument. And they got really vested because they did the work in the skeptic argument. So I flipped it, because I'm an activist teacher. I started with the skeptic argument and asked them to go research the other argument. So I'm an activist in how I teach, because I want certain outcomes, and I'll pay attention to how I teach it to try to get those outcomes. I'll participate in a march or a group. We volunteer. My husband and I, actually my family, we do forest and bird tree plantings, a wide variety of activities, really. And then we'll do it with our pocketbook as well. So we'll give money to causes that we believe in as well.
As an activist teacher and activist researcher as well?
Yep.
How does that sit with ideas of maintaining some sort of balance?
I tell my students what my bias is. I speak it straight out. And there's been interesting outcomes to that. Because I know my bias, I actually try pretty hard to give both sides to it. And a couple of years ago, I had mature students from that fifth year paper come to me. I give them credit. They got together on their own. There was four of them. And they came to say to me that they thought I wasn't saying strong enough to my students that they needed to be sustainable, that sustainability was the way, that I was giving them a choice. And from their perspective as mature students, they didn't think there was a choice. And so I said, oh, that's very interesting. Thank you, you know, for coming to me and talking to me about that. And I asked them to, if I could bring that to the class and that we could have a class discussion. And the class discussion was very interesting, with the younger students saying, you can't tell us what to do. That's not how we want the information. So I don't stand up there and tell my students that there's only one way. I think that there's a lot of different, and I've had students leave my class and be climate change skeptics, and we still stay in contact. So I guess it's space for lots of different voices and making my bias clear so they can make their own judgments. Critical thinking is what we are supposed to be teaching them to do.
What motivates you?
I guess nature was the first thing that came into my head. We have a batch with 38 acres that's off the grid, and with a gray water system and an orchard and garden, and we plant lots and lots and lots of native trees, and we have bees, and I go there to get regenerated. And so I would definitely say nature is the source of my inspiration. One of the reasons we moved to this country is because we like to tramp and we like to be outdoors. So we do a lot of that here.
What challenges do you have in the next couple of years?
Oh, that short-term thinking, I want more change quicker. So incremental change, I can't discount, and yet I have less and less time for, truth be told. And that's a challenge for me. Yeah.
If you could have a miracle occur by the time you wake up tomorrow morning, what would it be?
Oh. It's funny, in my head, I started with my management school, and I thought, no, too small. And then I started with the university, and then I thought, no, too small. I don't really know, but I think that something about more of a global shift towards what we've been talking about, quicker than what we've been talking about.
And lastly, do you have any advice for listeners?
Yeah, I think it's worth going out there and getting engaged, even when you get frustrated about the pace of change. But actually, it is still inspirational to get out there, do a planting or volunteer with the refugees. You know, there's, whether it's social or environmental side of sustainability that rocks your boat, there's lots to be done.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio.
You've been listening to Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. We're broadcast on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz, and podcast on sustainablelens.org. On sustainablelens.org, we're building up a searchable archive of conversations with people from many different fields who are applying their skills to a sustainable future. In our conversations, we try to find out what motivates them and what it means to see the world through a sustainable perspective, through their sustainable lens. In our conversations, we try to find out what motivates them and what it means to see the world through a sustainable perspective, through their sustainable lens. Tonight's Sustainable Lens was that of Associate Professor Eva Collins of the Waikato Management School. You can follow the links to Sustainable Lens to find us on Facebook, to keep us in touch. You can follow the links on sustainablelens.org to find us on Facebook to keep in touch. And you can listen to Sustainable Lens via iTunes as well. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann, and I hope you enjoyed the show.